Okay, first, to thank folks who helped me with the talk. The working title that I remember whether it was George or Dana gave to me was Observed Properties of the Solar Dynamo. That was far too scary. So I'm not sure what those would be, so I made a strategic retreat. Well, in talking about observational aspects of the solar cycle, there's just far too much to talk about. And so first I have to apologize. Even what I do cover will in some ways be superficial. And then many things just have to be left out in a talk of any finite length. And I've tried to make give you, at least up front, the framework that I used to put things in and leave things out. First, not to get too bogged down in details, there are a couple of points where I might, and I apologize, but I've tried to keep it mostly at the big picture level. Not to leave out some very basic, the classical results, so that, seeing that this is the beginning of a longer and theoretically oriented workshop, that there might be some people who are new to all the this law, that law, and that stuff, to just recall what those things are. To not to spend too much time on things that don't have a pretty high level of reliability, to give you some idea what their accuracy is. What I mean by stability is more like repeatability, how much you might expect it to vary between cycles. I'm not talking about measurement error now. And then the know-nothing approach, try to avoid too much selection on the basis of this is obviously an interesting theoretical property or it's not, but rather to look at whether, if it's cyclical, then it's a candidate. In fact, if it's constant, it's a candidate in some ways, it depends. And to try to make some judgment as to whether it's a primary property, meaning it's some fairly direct indicator, something interesting that might be going on in the sun, or whether you can at least imagine that it's fairly straightforwardly derived from something else. And it'll become more apparent what I might mean. So I won't, you'll see about what's covered, but what's not? Well, without regret, you can talk about every possible thing that varies with the solar cycle. And I think many of those things are at best these derived properties, and they're worth studying, but I don't think they tell us very much fundamentally. This is shorthand for the long-term behavior of the solar cycle over tens of thousands of years. Interesting, no doubt, but I'm not competent to evaluate it, and I don't know that there are any results that I really believe. Heliospheric properties, important in themselves, but there is so much filtering that goes on above the surface and out into the heliosphere that it becomes, I think, very problematic to interpret many of those. So they're interesting in their own right, but I don't say much about them. I hope that perhaps others will in some cases. I really would like to say more about this, and there are people here I hope who will expand on that, but it's I cover it very little here. All right, so the reliable classics, these, just to remind people and get the language straight. Well, the sunspot cycle. Here the point is to expose just how an absurd measure it is. It's 10 times the number of groups, where a group is whatever a standard observer says it is, plus the number of individual spots observed through some Platinum or INVAR telescope, and wherever it is now, Belgium, I think. And then the great observer's coefficient, right? And then that's the Zurich sunspot number. Well, I used to say, well, that's okay, because no matter, it may be this silly number, but it correlates with other things, so it must be good for something. And that's true to an extent. Okay, before we leave this, there are things you can take to the bank, which is, even if it becomes questionable back here in the Maunder minimum and the other minimum, and certainly all these, oh, are there 80-year cycles and Gleisberg cycle? Forget all that. I don't believe that any of it is securely known. But it is certainly true that the strength of solar cycles is measured by sunspots and almost any other measure, changes very substantially between cycles. So any theory has to account or deal with factors of at least up to 5 and possibly up to 100 variations in the overall level of activity between cycles. And then also the well-known fact that these peaks are not strictly periodic, but the time between peaks by any measure can vary by within from 9 to 12 years or so. Right? Those are all still true by any measure, including the sunspot measure. I won't talk much about the butterfly diagram. I stole this from David Hathaway. Nice plot. I think these are Greenwich groups, is that right? But this is what it's meant by the butterfly diagram, and you see why. The interest in it will become apparent later when you look at other ways to look at the latitude behavior of active region emergence. This is the classical butterfly diagram, where you're looking at, make sure we go through it, you're looking at latitude on the sun, and then in time this way. Joy's law, which is that when sunspot groups emerge, they tend to be tilted with respect to the direction of rotation, and Joy's version of that was that it varied with latitude, on average only a couple degrees at the equator, more at the active latitudes. We'll come back to this because there's a lot more to that, and people here who have worked on it. But this is all that Joy said about it. And I think it might have actually been Hale who said this part. Pardon? Okay. Hal already mentioned the Hale-Nicholson rules, which get put in various forms, but I'm not going to go through these, but I thought I'd put them down pretty much as he presented them, having to do with the that there are different polarities. The leading polarity is different in the two hemispheres. It incorporates Joy's law, that they are inclined with the leader close to the equator, that as the cycle progresses, you get so-called reversed polarity, or the opposite sense of polarity emerging at high latitudes, the signature of the next cycle, and then eventually those ones as they move, those opposite polarity regions as they move down become the dominant and they take over. And then it's the reverse in the next cycle, and therefore you have the approximately 22-year magnetic cycle. So these are what those rules are, if anybody refers to them. Okay. So now to talk about global properties. I said I wasn't going to talk about everything that varies with the cycle, and so I'll use 10-centimeter flux just as a representative of the battle of all the proxies that you can possibly use for a cycle. Most of the time I'll spend on photospheric magnetic flux, remind you of irradiance variations, and talk about what little we might know about fundamental quantities like stellar quantities, like the variation of effective temperature and radius, which by Stefan's law would also be variation in luminosity of the sun, as opposed to irradiance. Well, the 10-centimeter flux has often been used. It's a global measure. It's produced in a pretty well-known way by free-free and in strong magnetic fields, gyroresonance emission. And there have been a lot of studies. It's mainly due to active regions, almost entirely due to diffuse halos around active regions, and then above sunspots, there may be a quiet component. The point of showing this is that here's the 10-centimeter flux plotted against the sunspot number, and they have a correlation coefficient of 0.97 or something like that. So you could say that you could use one for the other, fine. But they are different. I mean, there's clearly not a linear relationship, and at any value of the flux of the sunspot number, these are not measurement errors. These are intrinsic scatter, and it's a fair amount. So I think for most theoretical issues, it probably doesn't matter, but they're all these measures, whether it's sunspot group, sunspot number, anything else you care that where they all have the same, yes, it goes up and it goes down. In detail, they are different. They don't peak at the same time. Most of them usually have a minimum at the same place. And there is a fair amount of intrinsic scatter. They don't measure the same thing. Photospheric magnetic flux, don't have time to talk about it, but I mean that itself is a not that straightforward a thing to measure. You think it would be, but if you compare different magnetographs of competent people who've spent a good deal of time concerned with the calibration of these things, they can easily differ by 30 or even 50% at a given epoch. I think overall that it's not that bad, and certainly the internal consistency of these data sets is much better than that. All right, so with the Karen Harvey gave me this updated plot, and you notice that SS max, that's a sunspot maximum, so that the peak of magnetic flux is rarely, in fact, it has never been for an observed cycle at the place where the flux does not peak the sunspot maximum. It's after maximum flux peaks. These are, I believe, rotational averages. So again, this is not noise. This is intrinsic variation of the magnetic flux coming up and disappearing in the sun. Now, it's interesting, and again, the modulation, about a factor of 3 to 5, from minimum to maximum. It's interesting to look at what that might be composed of. In her thesis, Karen Harvey looked at the difference in behavior of weaker magnetic flux, which was defined as a 3 Gauss threshold averaged over, 25 Gauss threshold. So there was no spatial information. It was simply take all the pixels on the sun and decide whether the apparent magnetic signal was greater or less than 25 Gauss. For those of you who are not familiar with magnetographs and you're thinking about physics, when solar astronomers and talk about magnetograms and say 25 Gauss, it has nothing to do with the actual magnetic field down there in the atmosphere. A little bit. It's an area average at best. And just so don't think that it has anything to do with the intrinsic plasma there. But there's a distinct difference. If you just take the weaker areas, you'll notice that the modulation from minimum to maximum is quite a bit less. Less than a factor of 2. And then much more than a factor of 2 for active regions. Now recently in some unpublished work, Karen and Dick White have have actually tried to use a spatial algorithm to divide the sun into these categories, active region, decaying region, enhanced network, quiet network. Of course, that involves definitions, but they are objective numerical definitions applied to the data. The interesting thing there is that the quiet network on the rising part of the current cycle does nothing, does not change at all. Now that could well be connected to the fact that all the quiet sun magnetic flux appears to be recycled on a time scale of 20 to 40 hours. Work of Shriver et al. A couple of years ago, and I think going back to a suggestion of Howard and Labonte even longer ago than that. But there's quite a bit of work done on that, and I think the bottom line is that in outside of any discernible active area, there's just the churning, recycling of magnetic flux. There's quite a bit of it, but it just comes and goes on a time scale of 20 or 40 hours. And although this is not a full solar cycle by any means, from what we know now, it could show essentially no dependence on the cycle. Well, irradiance. It's easy, even after a few years, to forget that this was a big surprise. Nobody really knew what the total solar irradiance was going to do. And all the ground-based measurements for 100 years had nothing to do with what actually turned out to be the case. So here is what you'll see as one person. This happens to be from Judith Popp, but many people try to give the best combination of observations. And here's a stab at it. It's all we have. That is, this is from the beginning of time as far as total solar irradiance is concerned. And forget the red line, that's just some attempt to follow the trend, but I look at it as an observer and I'd say there is no evidence from this that that one cycle is different from another based on this not quite three cycles. The modulation here of 2 watts per meter square out of 1365 is a very good number. Probably will not is good to actually a few percent of that, but it turns out that the absolute number is another question. Okay, I want to show you what's behind that though. Under the hood, it doesn't look so nice. And here's that nice curve, and then here are various instruments: Acrim 1, Acrim 2, Virgo on SOHO, ERBS. I think this is Nimbus 7, some instrument. They don't agree in their absolute calibration, by far more than their estimated errors, and so on and so on. It's a subject unto itself. But when you see an irradiance curve that looks something like this, keep that in mind that that a lot of fiddling went into it. There is no question that the irradiance varies in the sense that you see it there getting higher toward solar maximum, but and that the amplitude of it is probably this, but whether this cycle is different from this cycle and you compare the magnetic flux in this cycle with the radiance change or not, I just don't get to believe it. Now there will be, probably 5 years from now, there will be a successor to all these that will make absolute irradiance measurements with, we hope, up to 10 times the precision of any of these devices, which have all been basically the same in character. And then we may know the answer to whether, in another 33 years, whether it varies from cycle to cycle. So there have been many attempts there to compare the various irradiance variations, which is up here again, same plot you saw, with the photometric sunspot index, that's important for trying to interpret it, but magnetic flux, here's the center to wing ratio of the ultraviolet magnesium HK lines, little h and K. And some people have said, well, you know, this looks more like an irradiance than magnetic flux. As you can see, magnetic flux is distinctly higher here than here, and yet the irradiance seems to be near the same, and it's near the same. I don't know. That's why I showed you that other plot. I just don't think we can be sure of the relative calibration of the irradiance between cycles yet. And we'll never know, unfortunately, for these past cycles. Well, from the point of view of the sun as a star, it would be interesting if we could measure global parameters, effective temperature, radius, luminosity, and ask whether they vary in a cyclical sense. Well, it's a very tough business. I think the most persuasive of these is the work on spectrum lines by Gray and Livingston, which makes a reasonably good case for about a 1.5 degree change in effective temperature between minimum and maximum, with it getting hotter at maximum. They also claim to see perhaps a secular trend. I think that even they would admit that that's very speculative. Is it really a change in effective temperature? I don't know that we know that. As this line ratio probably does indicate the effective temperature of the plasma at the layers where it's formed. Right? That, I think, is believable. But whether you could really plug that into sigma T to the fourth, I still don't believe that we understand it that well. So I'd say this is interesting, but not yet certain. This is a sun as a star measurement, so it specifically does include activity. Yeah. And so there, yes, the answer to the question. Radius, the only point I want to make here is that people are trying hard. There's a chance for it, but I don't think anything is known. Here are some ground-based measurements. I'm not sure what this, does anyone know what SIRGA is? It's Italian, I believe, an Italian experiment. Pardon? French? Okay. Oh, okay. Well, here is their fit. The fit to 20 years of radius measurements, which, and here is an attempt from above the atmosphere, well, for only a small part of the rising part of the cycle, after trying to correct for many, many effects, where possibly there's a secular increase in the radius, and it's in exactly the opposite sense to the ground-based measurements. There's a balloon experiment which has been flying on and off for 20 years called the solar sextant, which I think is the best instrument concept which in principle could measure the solar radius variations. But it hasn't been published and it's not clear to me. So, bottom line there, I think it can only be done from space. Like the irradiance measurements, I think it will turn out, even though many good instrumentalists have tried, that all the ground-based measurements will turn out to be wrong or only adventitiously correct. We have to wait for space measurements. Okay, spatially resolved properties. That's just a preview of things I'll be talking about. There'll be some overlap here. I didn't have your topic, Peter, so I wasn't sure, and I'll skate over some of that and then skate over some things that David will be talking about. But I put some of that in for completeness. Well, just for people who haven't seen these things, well, thank you. I'm happy to. I should have put now. The reason to show this, I'll just let it run here in the background. Okay, I killed it. Good. Well, now maybe I can see the ad again. I never saw it before, so they cleverly built it in there. The purpose of showing it, these will be from Harry Jones. They're basically all the data that Kitt Peak has ever taken, the Kitt Peak magnetograph. Have I lost it again? Well, I don't think so. The quick time. Oh, I see. No, you see, if you do it that way, I'm afraid that it comes up and says that you have a virus. All right, forget that. Let's try the other movie. The purpose of showing this, I said, this is actually stolen from David. Are you going to show this, David? Okay, so I will not show this. But it does. In fact, I will because it's short. I did it again. That's good. All right. Now, the round and round. Well, the reason I show it is that when you're looking at these things, trying to decide what to believe and whatnot from from magnetic measurements 20 years ago and 30 years ago when they started is that they were hard. And this is the unvarnished truth, that it didn't look so good in the early days. Now, if I can move it on. The act is cleaned up much better these days. But you see that when you make synoptic charts and so on, you construct these from these, there's a lot that goes on. And I think every theorist should watch this movie, force himself to watch himself or herself to watch this kind of movie at least once, just to see all the nastiness that goes on. Nevertheless, they're in fact very good measurements. You just have to realize that that these kinds of charts over here require a lot of intermediate filtering before they look like the nice movie that will or will not show if I don't kill it as soon as it comes up. And if it doesn't come up, I'll move on. Okay. May come up in the middle of this slide instead. Well, as I go into these next things, which is here where I'm violating a little bit of the big picture thing I gave at the beginning, in that there's more detail, and I'm going to skate over some of it. It gets pretty grimy because the spatial and temporal properties of things that you think ought to act sort of the same don't always. And the net result of it is it's hard to know what to take away from that from the point of view of theory. Because some of the differences are definitely intrinsic, and others of them may be just because it's hard to define these things. All right. Well, there are people here who have actually done this work, so I won't go into this. But to try to get to a bottom line quickly, sunspots, individual sunspots from this very large Mount Wilson data set that Tom and others did some time ago, you would get a log normal distribution. And you can see it's sort of in this log plot. There's definitely a curvature, and then these are two basically fits. They'd both be parabolas in this plot. That's log normal. It's always that way. It doesn't matter whether it's solar minimum or solar maximum, and it doesn't matter which cycle it is. The shape just shifts up and down, according to how many sunspots there are. That's a good result. However, bipolar regions measured from magnetic measurements, magnetic flux measurements, in an equally careful way, do not show a log normal distribution. Right? I don't know what interesting you can fit it to various things, but this is also a log plot, and this isn't this. And that's also a good result. They are just not the same. In fact, sunspot groups and sunspots, now this unfortunately is now a linear plot on the x-axis here, but still log on the y. So this is the log normal distribution. But sunspot groups, defined in this case objectively by Howard, not this Zurich thing, but suffice it to say, in a sensible way, not a unique way, but a sensible way, sunspot groups and sunspots do not have the same shape distribution. Right? Okay. So there's much more to say about that, but I'm just trying to distill it as to they are well-measured properties. They are definitely different. In the cases of individual sunspots and these femoral regions, I think it is definitely intrinsic. They behave differently. In the case of the sunspot groups, it may be partly definitional. Sunspot motions. Well, this gets back into, we'll hear much more about it, I think, later. But I'll try to distill it way down. Larger spots rotate slower than smaller spots on average. At all latitudes, leading spots rotate a little bit faster than followers. However, those time averages conceal a different behavior, most of which is explained by the notion that young groups tend to expand rapidly as they come up, leader, follower spots. old groups tend to contract slowly. Even that statement is kind of, it's hard to quantify because sunspots disappear. Flux in the following region disappears, and that's an apparent contraction. But in any case, the effect on the measurements is old groups tend to contract slowly. Groups spend more time being old than they spend being young. Young people may want to reflect on that. And therefore the average, even though this is a slower effect than this, they almost balance out and they come up with these kind of small numbers here. But if you look at a given active region, a given state's development, these effects of whether the leaders actually rotate quite a bit faster than the followers because of this expansion effect. Moreover, the arrows there are indicating that there's tilting going on. So when you get back into Joy's law, that's a static presentation of a dynamic effect. Here's a quantitative look from Howard for spot groups and plages, magnetic plages, showing the Joy effect from 2 degrees near the equator to 6 or 7 degrees up here. This is a cribbed from Harvey's thesis, showing that, let me not try to explain this, just look at these diagrams. Basically, these are small groups, and the vectors show preferences of orientation. And the thing to take away from this is that large sunspot groups, which are going to be the ones that were the basis for Hale and Joy making the original statement, show the effect strongly. They tend to be tilted the way they say. As you go to smaller and smaller groups, they show less and less respect for Dr. Joy. Now, the other way to look at that is the penalty for flouting his reputation is that you are smaller and weaker. Because as you go, here is the peak angle, the one where you're supposed to be, and the average group with that correct orientation is quite a bit. This is a fairly substantial area effect. It's a factor of 3 times larger than you tend to be if you choose not to obey Joy. And Hal has already mentioned, it's also a dynamical thing. When they come up and they find themselves in a violation, they usually try to be good citizens and come back into alignment. The effect of that is, on average, contracting groups rotate counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere and clockwise in the south, right? And vice versa for an expanding group. Now, whether you believe that that's makes it good with the Coriolis effect, I promised not to talk about anything like, who was Coriolis anyway? We doubt. All right. There's been quite a bit of work on the inclination of field lines to the vertical, and it's a bit of a messy subject, so again, I try to distill it in words, at least my take on it. On average, the field lines for both sunspots and plages, where by plages here we mean extended magnetic field. None of these actually use calcium plages, the classical thing. They both trail the rotation, right? So rotating east to west, this would be normal trailing rotation, then leaning into rotation. They tend to trail rotation by a few degrees. However, this is made up, again, of leading and following polarities. Now, the leading and following polarities of plages tend to lean into each other at about 15 degrees. These are all average properties, right? However, spot groups tend to lean out from each other a little bit. All right, so if you think of a picture, maybe it's not so strange. Here's a couple of spots, and there's field lines in kind of an omega shape. If it's near strong fields, they kind of lean out from each other. Here are the more diffuse fields, and they kind of do this. Maybe. But, again, that even these, so here's the average property. Then you need to take into account that you have spatial information. Now, if you look in time, it gets more complicated yet. And this is where you really find things out, and that is when, if the plage is growing, this leading effect is really quite strong. In growing regions, look at the net average orientation of the field lines, they're really leaning into the wind by something like 25 degrees on average. That's pretty high. So that's something worth explaining. By the time they get to the decaying part, they're getting tired in their trailing rotation by a few degrees. If anybody has updates, or if this is not a correct distillation, please stop me. It's a pretty confusing literature in some respects. This is what I think is the net. Complexes are such an interesting and complex subject that I'm basically not going to talk about them, but I do, since I wanted to cover, at least make sure that important topics were had a placeholder at least. The thing to take away is that normalized to unit area, active regions are something like 20 or more times more likely to emerge within an existing region than outside one. There's a very strong preference for activity to occur where there has already been activity. These are, for those of you who haven't seen these stacked plots, let's not worry about it, but they're basically synoptic charts, little strips cut out of synoptic charts, stacked one on top of another. So this is time, basically. Both time and a little strip of latitude is represented in these plots. And things that recur, rotation after rotation, show up all over the place. Sometimes they tend to migrate forward in latitude, sometimes the other way. But this is a dominant feature of how active regions come up on the sun. The only reason here to revisit the butterfly is to stick in your mind that the sunspot butterfly diagram does not tell, the classical one doesn't tell the whole story, that the wings go out further if you look at ephemeral regions, regions that do not have spots. They appear earlier and at higher latitudes and then lead on into the sunspot belts. Right? This is almost up to date, so you can see how high they go in latitude to at least 60 degrees, and that the cycles overlap by more years than you would suspect from the sunspots. Right? For some reason, a few years ago, this upset people. I don't see why, because it's always been known that the cycles overlap. If you look in coronal manifestations, this is iron 14, so this is 1.5 million degree plasma, you can see that the overlap here is really quite substantial. And you see the same thing in the zonal flows. So there are two cycles going on or present on the sun all the time. I can skip over rotation. This is also cribbed from Beck. You've seen it. Here's his kind of a capsule conclusion, right? The surface rotates a little bit slower than immediately below it in the convection zone, and magnetic and Doppler tracers rotate a little bit faster than the surface. Dave will talk about the torsional oscillations or zonal flows. Here's a very recent version from Roger Ulrich with Mount Wilson data. These are fast and slow bands within the differential rotation. So think of the smooth differential rotation profile, and then there are latitude bands that lead it, and then some that trail it. It's a small effect. Black and white here saturate at 7.5 meters per second. Right. And it's closely connected with the behavior of the magnetic field. We'll hear more about that. Also hear from Dave that it goes beneath the surface. You can, it's a secure result that the zonal flows extend about 60 megameters below the surface. Meridional flows, others here, another murky subject. And Dave will talk about it. But what I took away from it is that I think it's pretty well established from a number of sources that there is a prevailing time average flow of about 20 meters per second to the poles, and that it probably extends 20 megameters or so, and maybe more, below the surface. Now, what happens after that? with these active bands? Are there secondary flows that get set up? The most common one proposes somehow that you can imagine one of these activity bands coming down from the pole, and it's connected with a zonal flow. And then is there also a meridional flow associated with activity in a sense that it tends to move away from the zonal flow? Maybe. There are indications, but I don't think that the meridional measurements either from helioseismology or surface traces have really established that yet. And nobody has observed the return flow. I don't even know if that's not really possible, that it's too small. It's got to be there. So I have to be very quick about interior properties more generally, but I wanted to give sort of a bottom line from the cycle point of view. Helioseismology has been wonderful. I mean, helioseismology has established that the interior dynamics of the sun, not only can you see the interior dynamics, but they're time dependent, and some of them are vary with the cycle. Remarkable. You can study them. But one thing that has become increasingly clear is that surface activity really modulates almost all these oscillation properties. So you have to take account of this superficial, the outer layers, because some of the modes respond so well to those boundary conditions that you've got to take account of that well in order to get good results about the interior. I probably won't go through this. Let me show you a movie. I can avoid foundering for the last time on a movie. From Rachel Howe and her collaborators. That is based on inversions of gong and MDI data, SOHO data, which shows, first of all, the zonal flows at the surface, near the surface, from helioseismology, and also a cutaway view. Now, the thing that I want to show you, this is kind of confusing. I don't even time to, the color scale is given here, so when you look at it on the web, you can figure it out. But this drawn in white is the base of the convection zone where the tachocline presumably is. And the thing that, I think Peter mentioned it, thing that people may believe, let's look at it one more time, and I'll be done, is play button, not kill button. Thank you. All right, of course these are longitudinally averaged inversions, so they have no structure in longitude. But this, going from red to blue, red, blue, fast, slow, is the possible 1.3-year oscillation in the tachocline. All right. Now, I'm not an expert enough to know whether you should take this to the bank, but I would call your attention to just below that. All sorts of interesting things seem to be going on, and the bottom line is that none of the practitioners agrees about any of that. So I'd say the zonal flow is very definite, and its extension to 60 megameters, definite. And everything else, don't quite know yet. Last slide, I think. I hope that someone, Paulette, will talk about, this seems to me to be an intriguing result, and I'd like to hear more about it. But I said I wouldn't be able to talk mainly about the heliosphere and things like the variation of flux leaving the surface into the heliosphere over a cycle. These are important questions, and I hope that Dave, Vic, someone will tell us more about these things. As far as giving a summary of something like a solar cycle, Buddha laughs, so forget it. Thank you. It's a statistical procedure where you basically look at, you take magnetograms, and which are line of sight magnetograms, and look at the apparent strength of the signal, which varies with longitude because the line of sight component is slightly different. All right, so if things are of the same strength, right, the same magnetic flux, but they're leaning one way or another, then it shows up statistically east to west. It's an indirect method, but it's been pretty carefully done.
You showed this magnetic variation and temperature quite separately, but shouldn't be any direct relation to the luminosity power.
Well, I say Stefan's law. I mean, you'd think, but first of all, irradiance is not luminosity. Irradiance is directed, and we don't know what the irradiance is in the above the poles, for example. So you can't. Pardon? If you believe that that actually measured effective temperature, then you would believe. Then you could compare the difference in the luminosity and ask, and then compare it with the radiance variations and perhaps find something about whether the irradiance is isotropic. But we think it isn't, A, and we haven't measured it, B, we know it isn't, okay, and C, that effective temperature measurement is just, it's the best there is, but I don't believe that it's a real measurement of TE in the stellar sense.
So 1.5 degrees is 41%.
Yes, yeah, so we give you far too much relative to what irradiance variations you see. You said, did you said 1.5 degrees gives to the fourth power, it gives tenth of, yes, it's in rough agreement.
There are two effects that...
Yes, but...
There are two effects that somehow we're in here. One is surprising because it doesn't show up at all. And then long periods where the activity is only seen in one hemisphere.
That is right. They always move forward. As to the north-south asymmetry, that's also true. It hasn't been as pronounced in the cycles where we've had magnetogram measurements, and I think that's an accident. North-south asymmetries themselves have a big confused literature, like north-south asymmetries in rotation, none of which I think stands up to scrutiny, but that one does. That's certainly true. Okay. Well, I showed two aspects of it. If they're bigger in the sense that there are bigger flux concentrations and they show up on a magnetogram as having higher flux, they have greater amplitude. Harvey and White attempt to apply a spatial decomposition scheme, and it's complicated. It's like a clustering scheme to try to classify regions. It's certainly true, however, that what they call quiet regions, if you look at a magnetogram, they are darn quiet, right? So if you look at a daily magnetogram, sun, and you just pick the dead quietest region you can, that would correspond to their definition, because they can actually show their classifications on a map of the sun. And those dead quiet regions, if you look at the amount of flux in those, so far the measurements that we have are consistent with those not caring about the solar cycle at all. I was looking for things that don't vary at all with the solar cycle, and there aren't many, but that's consistent with one of them.
I think we'll stop here at this point. We thank Doug again.
Sorry about that.